On this week's edition of New York Now, the legislature starts its first round of hearings on the impact of COVID-19. We'll speak with Senate Health Chair Gustavo Rivera about next week's hearings on nursing homes during the pandemic. Lawmakers passed a handful of new voting reforms last week. Senate Elections Chair Zellner Myrie has the details. Governor Andrew Cuomo, meanwhile, says the state budget has reached a breaking point without help from the federal government. Jesse McKinley from the New York Times is here to discuss. And a huge economic loss for Binghamton after an international event is canceled. But they've got a backup plan. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority will pass legislation.
We will pass a law prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Yet another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. Lawmakers left Albany last week after a short-lived special session. But this week, they've opened a new chapter in the state's response to COVID-19. They held the first of eight scheduled hearings on the impact of the virus Tuesday. This week, lawmakers were looking at the effect on higher education.
We are obviously deeply concerned about the way in which students, faculty, and staff have been impacted so far, but also have great number of questions about how we are going to go forward.
Next week, they'll hear testimony on the state's handling of nursing homes. More on that in a bit. But first, Governor Cuomo says the state budget has reached a breaking point if Congress doesn't send money to New York in the next week or so. With me in studio is Jesse McKinley from the New York Times. Jesse, thanks.
Of course.
So the governor has been saying this for 3 months, I think, 3 or 4 months, that the state has this budget deficit of billions of dollars because we're not getting revenue because of the coronavirus. It's been 4 months. Is he bluffing? It feels like, to me, it's like the gov who cried wolf.
Well, I don't know if it's bluffing so much as it's stalling. I mean, what's going on here is that basically they're waiting on the feds to act, you know, and to an extent, they don't want to, disperse their leverage by taking any action on a state level, which would then kind of release the pressure on the feds to kind of come in and bail them out. But as you point out, the clock is ticking, and we're pushing August at this point. There's going to be some serious cuts on the table if they don't get the money. They're talking about 20% across the board on schools, on other state services. So something's going to have to give relatively soon. And I think it's up to Mitch McConnell and the rest of the congressional leaders to make a decision. And I don't really know how much leverage the governor has over those sorts of people.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. So he said this week that the president has said in the past that he might be open to state aid and local aid. But the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, this is the context that I think that we're missing here, is that the Republicans of the U.S. Senate have said, we don't want to give state aid, and I think it was Mitch McConnell that said it would be a blue state bailout. So how far apart are they, I guess?
Well, I think the blue state bailout probably sent, Governor Cuomo's, ears ringing. That was not a happy day for him. I think they're fairly far apart. You know, I think the Republicans are dug in on this idea that New York has kind of made this bed by themselves far before coronavirus, that they were spend-happy liberals and that they spent too much and that they never want to raise taxes except on the wealthy, blah, blah, blah. So the Washington Republicans are very resistant to kind of making any sort of bailout of New York. But that being said, this is kind of a critical time for the Republicans as well. It's less than 100 days to election. Mm. I think the last thing that they want to be seen as is stingy to people that are really hurting. And, there's an argument to be made that New York's really hurting.
Yeah. How do you think this affects the political aspect of all of this? I mean, you're right. It seems to me like if the Republicans don't budge on this, and the Republican Congress members have to be advocates for this if they want to win in their districts, because as the governor said this week, it trickles down to the point of if you don't have the state delivering school aid, then property taxes may go up. So it's going to be felt by everybody, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a challenging map, political map for the Republicans anyway. I mean, they're not going to lose a Senate seat in New York because they're both Democrats, but there are vulnerable Republicans in the House who probably don't want to run on kind of a fiscal austerity message right now in New York. And, more broadly speaking, things like unemployment benefits, things like that, those are going to be issues that the Democrats try to make hay against the Republicans with, not only in New York, but also nationally.
So quickly, let's break down some of the consequences of if this does not happen. And we've heard this from, I feel like every time that we talk to him on a conference call or in the Red Room, he says the exact same things every time. The virus came from Europe.
Confirmed.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. The virus came from Europe. We're going to get 20% cuts if we don't get this money.
Yep.
So we're talking about 20% cuts to local governments, schools, and hospitals.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that would be devastating.
I assume that would be devastating. I don't run a school or a hospital, but it sounds pretty terrible to me. And you are right. I mean, consistent is one way of putting it. Repetitive to the point of exhaustion is another way of putting it. But Cuomo certainly stays on message with this, and his message has been since the very beginning when it became evident that this was going to be, you know, a multi-billion dollar hole. The other day he said $30 billion hole over 2 years. That they're going to need a federal bailout, and that if the feds don't step in, the state is going to have to cut, and those cuts are going to hurt.
Quickly, before I have to let you go, the state Division of Budget is scrapping the Mother Nature Bond Act, which would have been $3 billion for the state to borrow for environmental projects. Predictions on whether the legislature will pass it again next year so that it can go on the ballot again next year, or do you think that our financial situation might scrap it permanently?
You know, I've stopped making predictions since 2016 on anything, but I will say that that was a popular initiative, I think, that the governor came out with. I think it probably would have had support even from some Republicans. And so I would suspect it comes back to life next year. But once again, I didn't suspect that we'd be sitting here right now in the year 2020 talking about a global pandemic. So there it goes.
All right, Jesse McKinley from The New York Times, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
So as we mentioned, lawmakers will hold a hearing next week on the state's handling of nursing homes during the COVID-19 crisis. It's something they've been planning for months, and we're expecting some tense moments. Senate Health Chair Gustavo Rivera has been a harsh critic of the governor at times, and he's not one to stay silent when he disagrees. He says he'll bring some of that heat to next week's hearing. We spoke earlier this week. Senator Gustavo Rivera, thanks so much for being here on New York Now this week.
It is a pleasure to be with you, Dan.
So next week, you're holding hearings on the state's handling of nursing homes during COVID-19. Obviously, you and I both know that tragically, more than 6,000 people have died from the virus and been linked to nursing homes out of the state's about 30,000 death toll. Tell me what you're hoping to find out during these hearings.
Well, the first thing that I'll say is that you have to remember this is one in a series of hearings that we in the legislature are doing to kind of really dig deep into what were the responses in different parts of our state government. What are the things that we can do better? And as it relates to our healthcare system, whether it's nursing homes, hospitals, other home care settings, this is the first in a series of hearings that we're going to do, three of them, one of them dealing with hospitals, one of them dealing with upstate, and this is the first one is downstate nursing homes and other home care settings. So what I hope to do, the purpose of this is twofold. Number one, accountability. We need to have a clear version in a public discussion about what happened, how everything happened, what are the dates that are involved. I want to really break that down. Where are the accountability? Where are the places where things were broke down? Either whether we're talking about agency mismanagement or whether we're talking about particular entities or providers. I want to learn about all of that. And second, very much tied to it, is what are the changes that we need to do either administratively or legislatively to make sure that we are prepared so that when, hopefully never, but we likely will have something else, you know, this happen again, we make sure that that the unnecessary and unwarranted deaths do not happen.
So do we know who's going to be testifying next week? Are members of the Cuomo administration going to be there? Who are the key players that we're looking at in terms of witnesses?
Well, the Assembly and the Senate are still finalizing all of the discussion about the hearings and who is going to testify. As you can imagine, I think you might have covered hearings that I've done in the past. These are going to be long ones, and we want to make sure that we kind of organize it in a way that makes sense, right? We want to make sure that we have everybody, as many parts of this as possible. So we're certainly going to invite agencies from the administration, but we want to make sure that we hear from organizations that are service providers. We want to hear that we hear from family members. We want to hear from those folks who can tell us about what was the state of nursing homes and such before the crisis. What are some of the lack of resources that they had even before the crisis struck? And folks that have a clear vision about what we need to do in the future to transform our healthcare system to make sure that we can't, that these things don't happen again. So we're still working out all of that, all the folks who are going to be testifying.
So you're not looking just at, you know, the start of March through the present day. You're looking at how equipped nursing homes were before this all started and how that kind of was a domino effect into what happened. Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, certainly. I mean, listen, if you are being asked as a nursing home, for example, to do something today, I mean, but you didn't have the resources to do that even before the crisis came, and maybe it's because not of your own fault, but because of the fact that over the years, this administration might have been having an impact on how these nursing homes were actually reimbursed, what kind of resources they were given even beforehand. We got to ask that. It is all about providing the context, right? The crisis did not happen in a vacuum. When we're talking about lack of PPE, as an example, or the fact that some of the PPE that is required now in many of these institutions wasn't required before. You did not need to have N95 masks by the dozens in a back room. You did require them in a hospital because you dealt with people with respiratory ailments, et cetera, but you didn't have that need when you were a nursing home. So now that there's that requirement, I mean, when did that requirement come into effect? How did it impact their day-to-day operations? All of this is about providing context and making sure that we can understand how things happened, why they happened, and what we need to do in the future.
You and our viewers both know about this controversial executive order from the governor's office in late March that said that nursing homes couldn't refuse patients that were recovering from the coronavirus that were still testing positive. I know that that's made a lot of noise around the state, especially from people who were directly impacted by this disease. Is that something that you'll be asking about?
Absolutely. As I said, we want to ask about everything that led up to it. Matter of fact, I got this. I don't know if I give me a second. I got a paper calendar. I had to get Staples to dig out something that they, because if you go to Staples right now, they start in July. So I got them to get an old one out of the trash that starts in January because I'm going to have it here in my desk. And it's going to be about setting the dates. I want to know, when did the first case happen in the United States? When did it happen first here in New York City, in New York State? Where did the first death happen? I want to track it all in a visual way, at least for me, and many of my colleagues will be doing something similar, so that we can really get a sense of everything that happened. So the order on the 25th is absolutely part of our questions. It won't be not be the only one, but it'll be part of it, certainly.
I think it was about a month ago that the State Department of Health came out with its own review of what happened in nursing homes. They basically said that nursing home staff and visitors brought the virus in, and that was it for them. Case closed. They didn't want any other review. They don't want any other review. Tell me why these hearings are necessary from your point of view.
It's necessary because we need to hear in a non-biased setting. We need to hear. This is one of the reasons I love public hearings. This needs to be a public conversation. Certainly that study will be part of our conversation, but I want to hear from nursing home directors all across the state. I want to hear about what happened to them on a week-to-week basis. What are some of the things that they had to, choices that they had to make? I want to hear from service providers. I want to hear from family members. I want this to be a public discussion because we all need to know what happened, how it happened. Study by itself is not sufficient.
I'm really interested to see what comes out of it. Senator Rivera, I forgot to mention you're the chair of the Health Committee. That's why we're talking to you. Thanks so much for being on New York Now this week.
It was a pleasure to be here, sir.
We'll have an extended version of that interview online. Lawmakers are also planning a hearing on how the pandemic affected this year's primary elections in June. There were some obvious problems with that election, if you don't remember. Some didn't get their absentee ballots in time. Others had their ballots thrown out by elections officials. Some of those issues were addressed last week by the legislature, but Democrats say they're not done. Senate Elections Chair Selner Myrie joined me with the details. Senator Myrie, thanks for being on New York Now this week.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So last week, the legislature passed a series of voting reforms. You're the chair of the Elections Committee, so we saw automatic voter registration pass, absentee ballot voting for the general election because of COVID-19. And obviously, there was just this whole package. Not too many, but you obviously made some changes last week. Tell me, if I'm a voter, how this is going to change my experience when I go to the polls or as I'm getting ready to go to the polls.
You know, we saw an increase of about 1 million in absentee ballot requests from the presidential primary in 2016. There were about 1.7 million absentee ballots requested. And so what we saw, the scope of our democracy was larger and under a compressed timeline. And so there were an increase in participation, but there were also some problems. And what we did last week was an attempt to try to solve some of those problems ahead of what will be an even bigger turnout in November. So if you're a voter and you sent in your ballot, but for some reason the post office did not postmark it, if it has gotten there by the day after election, regardless of whether it has a postmark, your ballot will be counted. If you're a voter and you were voting for the first time in by absentee and you left off a signature or you put it in the wrong place or you didn't seal the envelope correctly, those technicalities under the old law would have discarded your ballot. You would be disenfranchised. One of the bills that we passed last week would say, we are going to give you notice if you have any sort of deficiency and allow you to cure that deficiency so that your ballot could count. Of course, automatic voter registration for the many folks in the state who are eligible to be registered but who have not. This is a bill that really moves the ball forward. Your interactions with state agencies will now automatically enroll you if you are eligible to vote. And so these are first steps. We will be holding a hearing on August 11th to see what more we can do. But I think we made some strides last week.
Ray, the primary election in June, I think you and I can both agree that it did not go as well as everybody had hoped. Some people, as you said, their absentee ballots never got to them until a few days after the election, so they couldn't vote. And then other people, they sent their absentee ballots in, and like you said, they couldn't be counted because they were just scrapped. So you had that bill that you mentioned that would allow voters to cure those absentee ballots. And you mentioned the hearings. I'm curious, what are you going to be looking at in the hearings, and what do you expect to come out of them? What people will be testifying to give you some insight as to what happened?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. There were a lot of problems that some we could have anticipated and others which we could not have. This is the first time that we were voting largely by mail. We have no idea where this pandemic is going to be in November. Hopefully, we are on the other side of the curve, but if there's a resurgence, we'll see even greater participation by absentee balloting. And so our hearing is meant to examine what further steps we could take, what we can do, for instance, with our relationship with the United States Post Service. There are going to be increased demands on post offices all over New York and, of course, across the country. But we need them to work in conjunction with our local boards of elections. We saw a disconnect, and there's an opportunity for us to fix that ahead of November's election. And there were also voter experiences at the polls that were unsatisfactory. There are folks who received misinformation, folks who were prevented from voting, people who, due to delay, stepped off of the lines because they had to go do something else. And so we're going to be hearing from voters. We're going to be hearing from local boards of elections. We're going to be hearing from community organizations, really to get the full scope of some of the problems and hopefully work out some solutions.
So you obviously have the bills that were passed last week. You have the hearing coming up, and the legislature's already done a lot on voting reform over the past year, over the past 2 years. I'm wondering if, as elections chair, you see anything in the future that you really want to tackle, any issues that really haven't been widely considered by the legislature that could spur voting and spur voting participation. Because as you and I both know, in New York, voter participation rate is below 50%. And you have to think, like, how can we get these people to the polls?
That's right. You know, I like to say that my job as the elections chair is to take New York from worst to first. And one of the areas in which we are the worst is in voter participation. And there are a number of reasons for that, but I think we have some solutions on the table that we can push forward. In the Senate, we passed online voter registration for the city of New York that is still awaiting the passage in the other house. And so hopefully we can get that done in the future so that we can make the registration process as easy as possible. I've also introduced the New York Voting Rights Act. We held a hearing on that right before COVID on March 3rd, which would put into place protections that the Federal Voting Rights Act does not. As many people know, in 2013, the United States Supreme Court removed the gut of that act that protected voter suppression and intimidation. And so what we would like to do is to see that done on a state level. In fact, we will be renaming the New York Voting Rights Act the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act of New York, because that's what he died for, that's what he bled for, that's what he fought for his entire life. And we think it's a great way to honor him, not just in name, but in substance.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it. Senator Zellner Meyrie, thank you so much for being on New York Now this week.
Thanks again for having me.
The major test of any election reform will be in November, when voters next head to the polls. But before then, we have a story for you on how a major event in New York has adapted to the COVID-19 economy. The LUMA Projection Arts Festival in Binghamton usually draws tens of thousands of people to the city for a stunning display in the Southern Tier. But this year, they're teaming up with Tri-Cities Opera to produce something that's never been done. And you can see it. Take a look.
This was one of those things where we had this plan to build, an entirely new way to present live musical theater with unique performances each and every curtain. And suddenly the world needed that. My name is Joshua Bernard, and I am the co-founder of LUMA Projection Arts Festival. So I moved to Binghamton, New York from downstate in 2005, and I just kind of fell in love with the town. As downtown became a better and better place to hang out, to live, we started to think about how we could develop more tourism. That's when we really started to think, we need to do something that's so outside the box, so original, so unique, that they were gonna come and check out this quirky little town because we were doing something that no one else was doing. LUMA is a festival that celebrates the convergence of art, of technology, and of narrative. Our core competency is projection mapping. So the art of transforming buildings with giant, powerful projectors and telling stories using the facades of these unique buildings. Now, projection mapping is the art of projecting giant, realistic-sized animations on the facades of buildings to create the illusion that they're transforming as if by magic. So City Hall turns into the Great Pyramids. So you walk through downtown Binghamton, which we've completely taken over in your own time. Everything's closed off the streets, it's all pedestrians, and every street corner has something to see that is just magical. It's like we suddenly become a theme park for the weekend. When we started, it was a lot of locals. We now attract an audience of 50,000 people, and Binghamton is a city of only around 40,000 people. For this project, we really, really wanted it to be free. And so it has been, as it has been in past years, we're relying on sponsors to pay for the event. And we also are running a GoFundMe. And this will actually be our sixth year of crowdfunding. People are fascinated by the stories. So everyone finds something to like at LUMA. And the crowds are just warm, lovely, and friendly. So, I'm kind of a news junkie, and beginning in February, I became a little bit convinced that we might not be able to do LUMA in the fall. You know, what happened with COVID and the economy was external forces said, you cannot produce the same thing you always produce. You cannot do it. As much as you want to do it, it cannot happen. And then we started to look at live motion capture technology. Could we actually do this live in real time over the internet, where the people you encountered in virtual reality were actors? And the answer is you can. The answer is not a lot of people are doing it. It's relatively new technology. I started to think, this is what LUMA can offer. We have the programmers, we have the technologists, we have the network engineers to build the technologies that would make art work organically, socially distanced from home, among a community. And our solution is Miranda, a steampunk VR theater experience. We're using some of the same core competencies and technologies for projection mapping, but instead of projection mapping, we're doing it with 3D animation and with virtual reality. We're building a platform to present live performance art over the internet that is fully immersive in a way never really before done. You can experience it one of two different ways. If you have full VR equipment, it's going to be a fully immersive theater experience. Or you can watch it streaming live over YouTube like a live animated film. Those are your two options. So our performers will actually be in a studio in Binghamton, New York, for every performance, every curtain, wearing full motion capture gear, and we'll be doing facial tracking and body tracking. And as they move in the real world, as they sing, so too will the avatars representing them in the story. So the opera we're producing is really a dystopian, steampunk, future Manhattan courtroom drama. It's a lot of things. And as the story unfolds, you are transported to various scenes in the lives of the characters to observe what happened and to try to figure out, sort through who committed this crime and why. There's a level of interactivity to it, and I think it's going to be incredibly exciting, incredibly compelling, but there's so much room to develop it. One of the things that's exciting about this format of viewing performance art is it has the best elements of doing a big giant Broadway show with 1,500 seats, so you can fit a lot of people in the house, but also the intimacy of much smaller immersive theater. And that's something that's really special. So COVID or not, I think this format of performing arts has a future, and this is a great opportunity to debut it.
That does it for this week, but don't forget to visit our website for daily coverage from the state capitol. That's at nynow.org. And follow us on social media at nynow_PBS. Until then, thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.